Talk Show.
Recorded live.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Talking Twilight Zone.
Aren't you going to jump?
Why, do you want to watch?
No, heavens no. But I was just thinking, if you aren't going to, perhaps you wouldn't mind giving me a lift into town? Now, I don't want you to change your plans on my behalf, you understand?
Come on.
Well, thank you. Wait a minute. I found a light.
Please allow me to introduce myself. I'm a man of wealth and taste. I've been around for a long, long year. Stole many a man's soul of faith. I was around when Jesus Christ had his moment of doubt and pain. Made damn sure that Pilate washed his hands and sealed his face. Pleased to meet you. Hope you guessed my name. But what's puzzling you is the nature of my game.
Mr. Witter, you suppose the Gazette could use a good linotype operator?
I doubt it. They just grabbed my best man today. Why?
That's my specialty, along with the reporting.
You mean you're a reporter and a linotype operator?
Absolutely. If I may dispense with false modesty, I'd count myself among the best in both fields. Perhaps the best.
The devil went down to Georgia. He was looking for a soul to steal. He was in a bind because he was way behind and he was willing to make a deal. When he came across this young man sawing on a fiddle and playing it hot, and the devil jumped up on a hickory stump and said, "Boy, let me tell you what, I guess you didn't know it, but I'm a fiddle player too, and if you'd care to take a dare, I'll make a bet with you. Now you play pretty good fiddle, boy, but give the devil his due. I bet a fiddle of gold against your soul, because I think I'm better than you." The boy said, "My name's Johnny, and it might be a sin, but I'll take your bet and you're gonna regret, because I'm the best there's ever been.
Johnny, rosin up your bow and play your fiddle hard, 'cause hell's broke loose in Georgia and the devil deals the cards. And if you win, you get this shiny fiddle made of gold, but if you lose, the devil gets your soul."
The person we can do without is you.
That's an ungrateful thing to say to a friend who pulled you out of bankruptcy and turned the Courier into the hottest journal in the state.
Well, let me tell you something, Mr. Smith, it's not worth it. I had a nightmare about a weird little man with a crooked cigar who caused terrible things to happen so he could get scoops for my paper. Well, I'm awake now, and I want you out of here.
Not so fast. What about our contract?
What about our contract?
You said you'd do anything to make your paper a success. I heard you. That's why I came. Well, I've carried out my part. You are a success.
If you're not a nightmare, then you're something even worse. Because somehow you made these things happen. You've caused tragedy. You've destroyed life and property. I didn't bargain for this.
Oh, yes, you did. But you put it out of your mind. You thought you'd get everything for nothing. That's not the way life works.
I live my life like there's no tomorrow. All I've got, I had to steal. He start on me to beg or borrow. Yes, I'm living at a face that kills. Ooh, yeah.
Open this door with the click of a mouse. Beyond it is a world of sound, thought, and opinion. In-depth discussions of television's greatest blending of science, superstition, imagination, and you're invited along. We'll be talking Twilight Zone.
Yes, indeed, everyone. We will be talking Twilight Zone. Thank you, Robert, for that wonderful opening, those clips and that music and everything. That was just outstanding. Love
kind of get us in the mood with today's show.
Oh, yeah.
Dealing with the devil, so to say.
Definitely. Some devilish music there. Very, very nice. Thank you so much for that. And, yeah, hi, everybody. Hello to my co-hosts, of course, Robert and Bobby Neer and Dave. Hello, guys.
Howdy.
And
hello.
Also to Felix in New Jersey is here. And Lou. Yay, Lou's here. So good to see all of you. And, yeah, today we're talking about
A bright spot in season four.
A bright spot. Definitely a bright spot in season four, The Printer's Devil. And I'm going to give it to you for that opening. You have any clips left? give it to you for the opening clip there.
Will do.
And now, Mr. Serling.
Take away a man's dream, fill him with whiskey and despair. Send him to a lonely bridge. Let him stand there all by himself, looking down at the black water. And try to imagine the thoughts that are in his mind. You can't, I can't. But there's someone who can. And that someone is seated next to Douglas Winter right now. The car is headed back toward town, but its real destination is the Twilight Zone.
Yes, the Twilight Zone, that's where he's headed. We have Douglas Winter. He's the editor of the Courier. It's a failing newspaper. And the guy feels like he has nothing left to live for. A bunch of his employees have quit, including his linotype operator, who was approximately 90 years old or so. And So Douglas Winter, he gets drunk and he goes up to a bridge and he's thinking about jumping into the water below and he's just about to do that. And then all of a sudden he's approached by Mr. Smith, who comments that it's a short fall and probably wouldn't do a very good job of killing him. And then he asks Mr. Winter for a light and says, well, if you're not quite ready to commit suicide, to kill yourself, could you give me a ride into town? So all of a sudden, Mr. Winter forgets about the fact that he wants to kill himself because he's amused by this little cute little old guy asking him for a ride, and he forgets about the suicide and basically forgets about everything, and he gives him a ride. So Mr. Smith and he start talking, and they get into an agreement. Whereas he'll provide the editor with the money to pay off his debts and continue the operation of the newspaper. And then he also signs up to replace the linotype operator and be the sole reporter. So Doug Winter, he has nothing to lose, so he agrees to it. And then the first scoop's a bank robbery, a huge bank robbery. And then business booms for a little newspaper because Mr. Smith outscoops all the other reporters from the rival papers. And he gets the story. And he does this over and over again, outscoops all the other papers for the big stories. And they're all the dramatic news stories. And so the Courier becomes a huge success because its stories hit the streets seemingly minutes after the events happen. And so successful that the man who's in the rival on the rival paper, the Gazette, Mr. Franklin, he tries to buy the Courier from Winter. And Winter's now in a position to say no because he knows that he's got a successful paper on his hands. And not many days later, there's a fire at the Gazette, and they accuse someone at the Courier of doing it, of causing arson. So with all the success the newspaper's having, Mr. Smith asked the editor to humor him by signing a contract guaranteeing continued success as newspaper editor in exchange for his immortal soul, pointing out that it's just your soul. It doesn't mean much, you know. What's a big deal? It's almost like an appendix these days. Not really necessary. That's what he tells him. And besides, since the devil's not real, Winter shouldn't have a problem with it. Winter thinks about it, and then he finally says, okay, you know, I'll go along with it. So He continues on with the paper, and eventually Mr. Smith makes a pass at Miss Benson, who is Mr. Winter's girlfriend. And she sternly rebuffs him. She even slaps him in the face. And she really slapped him hard, too. And Mr. Smith vows that Benson will pay the price. And in retaliation for this and trying to turn the screws on Winter, he writes a story that has the editor's girlfriend gravely injured in an auto accident. So the editor concludes that Mr. Smith is, in fact, the devil and discovers a story that has his girlfriend apparently dying. So Smith demands that Winter kill himself to fulfill his part of the bargain or Jackie will die. In desperation, Winter uses the linotype machine to change the story so that Jackie survives. And with Mr. Smith himself as a catalyst behind the steering wheel, trying to destroy Jackie as well, he also rewrites it so that Mr. Smith's contract is rendered void and he must leave. So when the car is found, Jackie's safe in the passenger seat, but Mr. Smith, of course, has vanished. He's a devil, so he vanished. And Mr. Winter decides to run the newspaper fairly and destroy the infernal linotype machine. Wow. Okay, so that was our story about the devil. Now, we didn't see the devil make an appearance at all in season 3. He was in seasons 1 and 2, but not 3. And I was starting to miss old Lucifer. But then he returned with a vengeance in this season. And in fact, it's one of the best season 4 episodes, mainly because of the incomparable Burgess Meredith. When Doug Winter sees those newspapers basically dying, he figures he should die too. Hits the bottle, decides to end his life. Smith comes along, rescues him. And, you know, with the ulterior motives. And, you know, now as lovable and charming as Meredith can be, he played the devil to evil perfection here. You know, he puts Winter's newspaper back on the map and, you know, gets those big disaster scoops. Winter's girlfriend, Jackie, she was quite perceptive, though. She knew there was something devious about Smith and tried to warn Winter, who finally confronts Mr. Smith. And at that point, you know, he knows he's got Winter backed into a corner. But the thing about selling his soul, okay, it sounds like a fair deal, but who sells their soul? I mean, wouldn't the very idea of such a proposition, no matter how frivolous Smith made it sound, wouldn't that be enough to make someone step back and say, whoa, wait a minute. You know, I mean, sell my soul? Everything's been typed into the linotype machine. Lightning speed came true. So when does the light bulb come on over Winter's head? Jackie smelled a rat, but Winter was oblivious. And, you know, Smith said he made modifications to the linotype machine. Well, yeah, he made them, that's for sure. He made them, but the price to be paid for those modifications was high. So thankfully,
the
Winter
question
did
I want to ask you, was that the original linotype for that, or was it he just took the original and fixed it up?
He modified
for his,
it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, it was the original, and he modified it in his own little devilish way. Yeah. But, you know, thankfully, Winter finally used his head. He saves Jackie's life, and, you know, Smith got pissed off by a rejection of his devilish advances, and that tries to kill her. But yeah, the car ride itself, when he was taking Jackie, you know, down the road there, that was particularly suspenseful. I mean, I thought the whole episode was very well done, but that part was suspenseful, and the whole episode did have a good Twilight Zone feel to it. The dark setting of the newspaper office helped make the atmosphere more ominous, and of course Burgess Meredith was outstanding in this
mm-hmm.
episode. Which,
definitely.
Unfortunately, yeah, absolutely, and unfortunately would be his final Zone appearance, but I never tire of watching this man perform. He was great as the Penguin in Batman, and even greater as Rocky Balboa's trainer in the Rocky movies, and my favorite of his TV episodes will always be Time Enough at Last. I mean, that's my all-time favorite Zone episode, but he was also very memorable in The Obsolete Man. And, yeah, he was in One Dud, you know, Mr. Dingle the Strong, but he was still charming as Luther Dingle, you know. And Robert Sterling played Doug Winter, and he was not particularly memorable, but he played his role adequately, I thought. And Pat Crowley, she was a good actress, and she was, you know, she was good as the girlfriend and very, very perceptive at that. And Ray Teal, he played the rival newspaper's editor, but many folks might remember him as Sheriff Roy Coffey on Bonanza. So, anyway, I enjoyed the episode. It was fun watching Burgess in this. Especially during his lightning-fast typing scenes in this episode. I love the one when they were showing him typing. That was awesome. But I'm rating this a 4. I really did like it, and for a season 4 episode, that's a high rating, but it deserved it, in my opinion. So, Robert, off to you.
Thank you, Lynn. Yeah, I really enjoyed this as well, and like I said, there's not very many bright points in season 4. And, you know, we had 8 previous episodes that were kind of or average. And this one really, you know, stepped it up. And then we get a couple more that, we're okay. Then the rest just seemed to go downhill, except maybe a few here or there that was okay. Mm-hmm. But anyway, trying to get myself together on this. Very much felt like a mini movie, wouldn't you say, Lynn? Anybody there?
I think Lynn's having trouble with the headset.
No, I'm sorry. My headphones fell off.
Ah, you're the corporate.
I'm sorry. Yeah, my headphones fell off. I apologize. I was like, oh, my God, and then I had to look under the desk for them. Sorry.
Uh-oh, the devil. Well, see, he's at work with this episode today. So. But I was saying, didn't it feel like a mini movie to you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And with that dark feel, like a film noir type of thing.
Mm-hmm. And that's what it felt like to me. Of course, Burgess Meredith's wonderful as Mr. Smith, and all the years that we remember the personification of the devil in different films and stuff
absolutely.
Like that. But pretty much a genie in the bottle situation with this story. I guess Rod had this thing for It's a Wonderful Life or Scrooge, because it seems like some episodes we have the template of, you know, It's a Wonderful Life with this one where, you know, the Jimmy Stewart character is thinking about jumping off the bridge, but Clarence comes
along and
save him from doing that. The same thing with this one, you know, the devil comes along and saves Winters from diving off the bridge there. So, yeah.
Felix likes the cigar.
Yeah, that is kind of cool, the old crooked cigar thing, but.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a role for Burgess Meredith that probably is not unknown to him. You know, he's a very character actor that, you know, knows his roles. He's probably played the devil in theater and maybe in other roles or whatever. So it's probably nothing new to him, you know, how to react, how the devil would tempt a person and then bring him in and then finally, you know, throw the book at him, so to say, you know, about...
He was so good, too.
Yeah, he had a way of trying to build the suspense of the episode up and to the point to where things going good for Winters, and then come time to pay the devil, so to say, and the little confrontation in the office there where taunts him, well, you know, you don't believe in the devil. So go ahead and sign the paper. It don't mean nothing. Like you said in your review about the soul means nothing. And, you know, you said it was like appendix and all that. Yeah. So if you want to keep the good times rolling, so to say, you got to sign the paper. I mean, you know, it's the stuff that we see in past and present movies about the devil. There's a new commercial for a car out, if anybody's seen it, with, is it Ramirez? the actor who plays the devil in the car commercial, where the guy is sitting in a cafe and he's looking at the ad for this car, and he says, "I can give you this," and everything else that goes with it. And then at the end of the commercial, the guy sees the price and he says, "No, I can deal with this." So it was kind of a...
Well, I didn't see that yet.
Thing. Yeah, it's out there. Very much reminded me of Ghost Rider, if anybody remember the movie Ghost Rider with Nicolas Cage and...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And, Peter Fonda is the devil in that one. So. Yeah, very much reminded me of the stories of the devil and Daniel Webster, Dazzled for one, Angel Heart is another one. De Niro played a wonderful devil in that movie. And we had series like Reaper and the devil in that series for, I think it was a couple of seasons. So, for the disappointment for season four, I really did enjoy this episode. I mean, on some of the season four episodes, I would fast forward them or get bored or they'd just be plain terrible. But this one, I was able actually to watch this episode as a whole and really enjoyed it. Yeah, there is some filler in this one. You know, not as bad as down the road where we get, you know, half of this, you know, episode filler.
Yeah,
the half of it is the story. But, yeah, I really so badly wanted to give this a classic because, you know, we just finished up on the site our review of The Bard. Thank goodness that one's a whiff. That man. And I can't believe Helen. Oh, I was so happy when Helen gives something like we gave, and it was like, wow, really?
I know. It seems like she always like is on the other side of the spectrum.
I'm just glad we're done with in writing form season four. So,
yeah.
Now, compared to the other stories that's coming up, this one was quite nice, and I really did enjoy it. And some of the things I did bring up, I do have trailers for. As I mentioned earlier, the Devil and Daniel Webster is a 1941 movie. And, of course, it has starred Walter Houston, who played Mr. Scratch, or otherwise known as the Devil. You had Edward Arnold as Daniel Webster. And basically... about a New Hampshire farmer who makes a compact with Satan for economic success. He enlists Daniel Webster to the contract. So here is the trailer for that.
Mister, that sounds all right. But how do I go about it?
Clever man like yourself. He can find money anywhere. Money to pay his bills, money for his wife and children, money enough to be a rich man. All he needs is a friend to point it out to him. Like this.
Thus begins one of the most enchanting yet stirring motion pictures of our time. A story so enthralling in its unique conception, so thoroughly gripping in its entirety, that mere words cannot describe it.
Daniel! 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 Oh, no. No, not now. I have so many things to make up for.
I'll give you until midnight.
So you can tell by the music there, it's got some comedy elements in it as well. But
yeah, but that was a good movie and a good book, too.
Did you like the book better than the movie? Or?
Yeah, I actually did.
Yeah, sometimes the movie don't do the book justice, yeah.
Yeah, I did like the book better, but the movie was good.
And another one that I brought up, too, was Angel Heart with... De Niro as the devil. And it very much, it came out in 1987, very much reminisced Dark City in a sense of, it kind of reminds me of Dark City and Jacob's Ladder a little bit. And if you guys have seen Jacob's Ladder and Dark City, you might have an idea of what I'm trying to say with Angel Heart. So here's the trailer for this.
Harry Angel has been hired to solve more than a mystery.
He's dead, Mr. Angel. And if he isn't, he is to me.
Are you afraid?
Yeah, I'm afraid.
To find more than a killer.
We don't go around murdering people, all right, Mr. Angel?
The Prince of Darkness protects the powerful.
And it may cost him more than his life.
Some religions think that the egg is the symbol of the soul. Did you know that?
All I know is Johnny's running around bumping off everyone he used to know. And more it's me who's on the line for it.
Johnny Favorite was as close to true evil as she ever wanted to come.
There's death everywhere these days.
Killed them. They're trying to pin it on me.
The flesh is weak. Only the soul is immortal. Did you kill him?
I got a way out.
You gotta burn for this, Angel. You gotta burn for this, Angel.
In hell, now, now, now.
Harry Angel has been hired to search for the truth. Pray he doesn't find it. Angel Heart.
And I kind of like that, the psychological movie. Lisa Bonet got her start in this. You remember Lisa Bonet? She Crosby Show.
Crosby Show, yeah.
Yeah, she went into movies, and that was the first movie she was in. And Mickey Rourke as the detective, Harry Angel. So, yeah, it's very graphic, unfortunately. It's got some sexual overtones in it. But De Niro plays a wonderful saint.
Oh, God, I can never watch something like that.
Yeah, you have to have a few drinks to knock the edge off when watching this movie. So
my goodness.
But the ending is great. I'm not going to tell you what the ending is, but the ending is wonderful and what it comes down to with the whole movie. It's great, man. And my last one I'm going to throw out to you.
You mean there's nudity in it? Just nudity?
Just to raise a few eyebrows.
There's nudity in it that I certainly cannot watch. Me and Radar on that, you cannot watch nudity.
I'll tell you what, though, if Radar could figure out a way to send a girl back home piece by piece instead of a Jeep, he would have figured that out. But.
All right, that's right.
Back to Iowa. Okay, like I said, my last one is Bedazzle. It's a remake of the 67 one with Peter Cook and Dudley
Brendan
Moore.
Fraser, right? That's been Brendan
Fraser
in it.
Is this one, and Elizabeth Hurley's in it. She plays the devil in this one. And here's the theatrical for that.
Elliot Richards needs a life.
You're the man, Elliot.
It's all about first impression.
Go over there, say hello.
But most of all, he wants Allison.
Hi.
Hi. Do I know you?
Oh, I sure hope so. We've only been working together for the last 4 years.
I don't think I've ever seen you before.
You know, I'm here with some friends, and I was wondering if maybe you wanted to...
Elliot has never had any of his dreams come true.
I would give anything to have that girl in my life.
Until now.
Hello. You're very glib. I bet you're a whiz with the ladies.
Well.
Let's go someplace quiet so we can talk.
Okay.
What if I told you that I had the power to give you anything and everything you've always dreamed of?
Who are you?
Promise not to tell anyone? I'm the devil.
Yeah, right.
am the devil, Satan, Lucifer, the Prince of Darkness. Well, the Princess of Darkness, anyway.
Why don't we take a look at the contract?
I, the devil, with offices in Purgatory Hell in Los Angeles, will give you 7 wishes for 1 piddling little soul.
Is this real?
It could be. Sign it, Elliot.
Okay, I wish that I were married to Allison, and that I were very, very rich, and very powerful.
You got it.
Muy buenos días, señor. ¿Le apetece algo de comer?
¿Cómo dices? No hablo español. Un momento. ¡Realmente estoy hablando español!
¡Hola! ¡Mucho gusto!
No, gracias. Soy alérgico a los crustáceos.
Elliot may have 7 wishes.
You turned me into a drug dealer!
What's the big deal?
You asked for rich and powerful.
But she's not going to give him...
Back so soon?
...a chance in hell. Bedazzled.
Nobody gets it totally right away. That's why you get 7 wishes.
Besides, do I look like somebody who tried to trick you?
That movie very much, as I said, with the genie in a bottle situation, with the different wishes and different trials. I like the one where he's supposedly gay or whatever, and there was another one where evidently he was him and her was on a beach and was always an emotional type person about the tuna and all that stuff. It's an okay movie, not as good as the original, but
I'm not a big Brendan Fraser fan, but I did like that movie. I mean, I don't like a lot of the movies that he's in, but I did like that one. I'd like to be dazzled.
Yeah, and you know, there's a lot of movies with the devil in it. There's the George Burns one. Oh God, you devil!
Yeah. Oh God,
that was great. Where he was playing both God and the devil, and the devil drives a sports car and listens for the daily soul pickup, so to say, in that one. So.
Never be another George Burns.
No, like I said, I really so desperately wanted to get this a 5 out of 5, but I couldn't. And the reason why I couldn't is the whole way out for winners with the linotype machine as escape from the situation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Just showing that the devil was not that bright by not disconnecting the machine, dismantling it, or making it non-functional. So, and of course, this is based on the Charles Beaumont story called The Devil, You Say. So I ended up giving a 4.5 out.
4.5. Yeah, 4 out of 5. Yeah.
Or right, 4.5 out of 5. Yeah.
But when you think about it, if you think about all the other episodes, you know, Twilight Zone episodes with the devil always outsmarts everybody else. And this is the first one where he didn't.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's kind of weird. I mean, it's kind of tough to outsmart the devil. I mean, you see, like, in Escape Clause and The Howling Man and, you know, all the episodes that had the devil in it. And the devil always seems to win out in the end, but yet this one didn't. So,
I don't think the devil would intentionally leave a point like that undone. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So. Way too smart for that. I mean, he's evil enough to be, but you know, he's smart.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and pass it on to Bobby. Bobby.
Well, when we did an episode earlier in this dreadful and agonizing and putrid hour-long season called He's Alive, I said there were a handful that I could at least tolerate, and this is one of them. Naturally, as has already been mentioned, it suffers from the usual hour-long problems. It's way too long, makes its point early in the first half, would have been much better as a half-hour episode. But overall, for season 4, it's an episode where, for once, I don't have to hold one hand over my mouth and the other over my eyes while it is on. And the main reason, as Lynn has already pointed out, is Burgess Meredith. He was one of those actors who brought more to everything he was in, actually, than it really deserved. Excuse me. And that's the case here. Now, the story itself is as old as can be, but, you know, my goodness, does this series have to depend endlessly on the devil and the stupid people he encounters who make deals with him this is just another one, but it does maintain interest in spite of the familiarity. One of the things that hurts this episode and all of them, the longer the series goes on, as far as I'm concerned, is that minuscule budget that CBS allowed Serling. How do you run a newspaper with just the owner and his secretary? I know they couldn't afford a few extras to just mill around inside the building. I know most of them have been laid off, but still, you know, it just looks ridiculous. It's no wonder they're going out of business. The other thing is that not only this episode, but all of them, look cheap. They look like they've been shot in Rod Serling's basement. It just doesn't help any. It doesn't even look like a TV show. It's really sad to sit there and watch such a famous series, still talked about it half a century later, and realize that, you know, they just took all the money away. I'll never understand that in a million years. The story itself is full of holes, as has already been mentioned by Lynn and Robert, the problems with it. But for season four, it isn't all that bad. I could probably see my way clear to give it a rating of 3 for good. And that's pretty high for me, considering the things I have said about season four. I don't think it's a classic or anywhere near there. But it isn't bad. I didn't fall asleep during it. And as Robert mentioned, I believe I didn't fast forward or anything like that.
Thank goodness, I don't know.
And Burgess Meredith, as I said, is the main point of interest. And rather than rehash this episode, since it's already been done, I would rather say a little about him, since this is, as Lynn pointed out, his last of four appearances in the zone. Now, I've never read this on the web, but it looks, at least to me, as though in the four episodes he was in, he was actually handpicked for the stories he was in. Certainly in Time Enough at Last and The Obsolete Man, and even in The Dreadful Mr. Dingle, which nobody liked, and certainly here, it's hard to imagine anyone else in these roles. It's almost like they looked around and said, we need somebody for this. Let's get Burgess Meredith. He'll be perfect for it. So you don't always see that in a lot of episodes or in movies either, where you wonder why certain people were picked since they look completely out of place. But he always looks to be exactly where he belongs when he's in one of these stories, that's for sure. Now, I went to the Internet Movie Database, IMDb, like I always do, and I found a few interesting tidbits about him that I'd like to mention. He lived to be 89 years old, and unfortunately, he passed away from Alzheimer's disease, but not before he became one of the best character actors in the business, that goes without saying. And back in the 50s, he was actually back in the 50s blacklisting mania. He was blacklisted like so many people in show business were for his liberal political views, absolutely outrageous. But he managed to survive it and go on, luckily for us. In this particular episode, it's kind of funny to see him puffing away on that hideous-looking cigar, although personally I would call it something else other than a cigar, since a few years later, after this episode, he had a lot of trouble doing just that. And this is from IMDb when he was in Batman, which is 1966. On the Batman television series, he developed his grunting penguin laugh out of necessity. Meredith had given up smoking some 20-odd years earlier. That would have been 1946. But his character was required to smoke with a cigarette holder. The smoke would get caught in his throat, and he would start coughing. Rather than constantly ruin takes in this manner, he developed a laugh to cover it up. He said himself, actually, it was a pretty funny noise for a penguin to make. I sounded more like a duck. Needless to say, Meredith gave up smoking again immediately after the series ended. How he did it here is beyond me. We're only talking about a couple of years before. He didn't seem to be having any problems. God only knows how many takes they had to do to get him to stop coughing. But he gave up cigarettes, and he wasn't kidding around about it. He just couldn't take it anymore. Something funny about, I find this rather amusing. He is, of course, very well known for being the penguin in Batman, but he wasn't the original selection. They didn't want him. They wanted Spencer Tracy. But Spencer Tracy wouldn't do it, it says here, unless his character was allowed to kill Batman. Obviously, they did not want to kill the main character, so the role went to Meredith. Obviously, Spencer Tracy never read a Batman comic book in his life. I mean, his character was going to kill Batman. How ridiculous can it be? Also, Burgess Meredith was fascinated by the subject of non-human intelligence, particularly dolphins. He once believed that a dolphin somehow called to him for help in the middle of the night, while he was staying at a friend's home on the beach. He ran out and found the dolphin, caught it in a net under a dock down the beach. Although there was no way he should have been able to know it was there, he released it, saving its life. He believed it had made some sort of connection with him, perhaps telepathically, to call for help. Sounds like a pretty good Twilight Zone episode, if you ask me. Probably better than this one. Now, you know,
that's kind of neat, Bobby, because it brings up the Sequest and Roy Schreider character in that series.
Right, I remember. Yeah. It's always nice if an actor understands and accepts what he's good at instead of trying to take on roles that, you know, just don't fit. Because he was once quoted as saying, "I was born a character actor. I was never really a leading man type." So he certainly knew what he was talking about, and he played along with it. And just for the hell of it, even though we all know what a character actor is, I Googled to find a definition and found this. Character actor, an actor who specializes in playing eccentric or unusual people rather than leading roles. And I don't know that anybody really ever did it better in the acting business than he did. So anyway, I can tolerate this episode. I'm not wild about it, despite its being familiar. And as has already been mentioned here, it provides too easy a way out for the people in trouble with the devil. I mean, usually he wins. So it's hard to believe that all of a sudden, out of nowhere, there's an episode where people beat the devil. Because throughout the Twilight Zone, every time the devil's, I mean, as Lynn already mentioned, he already escaped when he had him trapped, and there's just no stopping him no matter what. These people managed to beat him, so I hope they went on and told everybody else how to do it. Now, one more thing before I pass this along. For those people who receive MeTV on their cable systems, that network is currently showing hour-long Twilight Zone episodes from Season 4 on Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time. Now, tomorrow, Sunday, they just happen to be showing the third episode from this season that I don't mind, and that's on Thursday We Leave for Home, which we have not discussed here yet, although we did review it. It's that very rare Season 4 event. It's actually worth watching. Everybody liked it except Robert. Robert only gave it a 1.5, so Robert should watch Sunday Night Football.
Yeah, that's what I'll do.
Anyway,
instead of watching from Thursday. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll give it a 3. It's really not bad. Lynn?
Okay. Bear fan Ron, he said that, Bobby, you remind him of Spencer Tracy.
Why? Is there a reason for that? Do I talk like him or what? I didn't notice that.
Possibly. I said, and I'm sure that I remind him of Katharine Hepburn, but he said, no, I remind him of Betty Davis. Yes, I remind him of Betty Davis. So now I'm going to turn this over to Dave.
Well, I am honored to be introduced by a star. Thank you very much.
Yes, well, darling. Yes, really.
Yeah,
I always wonder what happened to Baby Jane. Anyway.
Oh, she's still alive, darling. She's right here.
Well, I always like to start out with just some basic facts, because, I mean, I know there are lots of people that go to the Yahoo.
Speaking of something, Dave.
Just to remind you, everybody, obviously, this season 4, episode 9, the 111th, it's its 111th birthday, Robert. If you're thinking from a famous hobbit who had his 111th birthday. And it went out on the 28th of February 1963. Amazingly, I was just checking, Burgess Meredith is only 55 here. Looks a little bit older, and the typesetter you mentioned, the one that said he looks about 90, Charles P. Thompson, was 72 when this aired. Amazingly,
he looks like he's 102.
Yeah, amazingly though, Robert Sterling, who plays the lead role, he's 46, where he looks, he's sort of in his mid 30s to me, and Pat. Who played
Jack Crowley?
Yeah. It's just 29, but I thought she was rather attractive. She was. 29. But in those days, you know, you put pearls around girls, you know, put a twin set of
pearls
always
on
them,
older.
And it makes them look older. But she reminded me, and I used to have a crush on the Perry Mason's secretary. I can never remember the actress's name.
Yeah,
one played Della. Yeah,
the one that played Della Street or something, was it? Yeah. But this girl reminded me of that. That was a sort of what a real hot-looking chick looked like in those days. So I like that. I noticed. I recognised the bloke, as you said, was in Bonanza. I couldn't remember what part he played, but you said, was it the sheriff he played? So
the sheriff, yeah, Ross. I forget what his name is. Yeah, the sheriff.
Yeah. So I liked it. I thought it was quite nice.
Roy Coffey.
That's it. Thank you. I thought there was quite a nice development. I don't think it was overly stretched out. It obviously had to be. I mean, in some ways, you can't go from 25 to 52 minutes without some padding in there. But I thought it was quite well. I thought the tone changed nicely from a sort of a idiosyncratic man that comes into his life. You know, think he's a bit of a loon that's got more money than sense and is perhaps lonely and just wants to join them. And then we have this very turning point where things start to get quite dark. And the part where... you know, we are letting on the secret early on the bridge, that this is somebody out of the ordinary because he lights his cigar with his thumb there. But, of course, the other people in the story don't see that until we're fairly late on in the stage when the newspaper owner is not quite sure who he's dealing with. And then he lights... And, of course, not only was it a very crooked cigar, it appeared to me, to be the same cigar all the way through. In other words, it didn't seem to actually burn. It was the same cigar that he was smoking all the way through.
Well, Dave, it was a Wonka cigar, you know, Willy Wonka. Anyway.
Yeah.
Oh, and Dave, that's Barbara Hale. Barbara Hale.
That was it.
Yep.
Oh, yeah, real
yeah.
looker.
I just
yeah.
thought of it. Barbara Hale, yeah.
Thank you for that. I thought that movement went rather well. Now I think the solution at the end was slightly simple, but I think there was a slightly light-hearted tone in it that sort of that worked. I mean, in one way, I thought he was going to get out of it because, of course, if you sign a piece of paper, and of course this is what the reporter wrote at the end, and you're convinced you're not actually signing anything of any worth. I mean, because Burgess Meredith's character says, well, you know, if you don't really believe in the soul, you know, just humour me as an old man. It seemed as though he's been defrauded of his soul rather than, you know, making a pact with the devil. You've got to do it voluntarily, of course. The other thing is, the other get out for this, when you said that, you know, it's not usual for the person to beat the devil. The devil, the character said towards the end, when he'd said about the girl dying in a, well, not dying in a car crash, in a car crash, he said he'd left it open. He'd left it open, the outcome was still uncertain. So because the press was still, you know, in operation and the story hadn't come to, you know, the final full stop, as it were, then that was the way in that he could do type it. He probably, of course, as well, when he first meets the newspaper owner, he's just lost his linotype operator. And one of the reasons why he's feeling as though he can't go on is because he hasn't got a linotype operator. So it would be within the bounds of possibility for the character then to think, well, he didn't have those skills. This is the first... and one of the other things I thought was right amazing was that when the newspaper owner was typing, he was typing nearly as fast as the devil guy was, because you know, he was trying to save the girl. So it wasn't a very, you know, serious and well reasoned denouement, or whatever the word is, but I thought it was good enough and strong enough for the show. And if the devil wins three times, perhaps it's about time we win one out of three. There's always going to be some element of chance. And so, yes, I enjoyed it. I think I'm with Robert. I give it 4.5 out of 5. It's probably the nearest to giving five that have come to. No, I'd certainly give it four and a half out of five. I enjoyed it. I liked, the whole way it moved along. And I thought the characters were quite likeable. We did see a couple of guys working in the back shop towards the end, when he was re-recruiting, because he tells Burgess Meredith he's going to get the typeset back. That never happens because we don't get that far along in the story. But when there is a confrontation in the room, we do see a couple of other guys working in the back of the office. So a very good episode, I thought. Certainly the best, perhaps, we've seen in season four so far. And
I enjoyed it.
Yep. So I was very pleased with it. And I've only just finished watching it prior to going to this recording, so it's all pretty fresh in my mind. And enjoyed it. Thank you.
Cool. All right, Lou.
All right. Okay. So I pretty much agree.
Okay,
with
that's it,
here.
Lou. Not for you.
If they had said that to his character, maybe that would have been the end of the story. It was a good episode. I actually enjoyed it. I mean, like everyone said, I think the strength of the episode is Burgess Meredith. I mean, it's not, he doesn't just play the devil. He plays the devil with like a hard sell. I mean, he comes in there all swaggering and all loud and boisterous. I'm like, oh, you're going to go kill yourself. Okay, I understand. You should do whatever you want with your life. Hey, but before you do that, you mind taking me to town? You know, he's really very charming in this episode. I just love the way he portrays himself. You know, he doesn't portray himself as kind of a, you know, he's not trying to do a soft sell. He's just very boisterous, loud. He's kind of a jerk in a weird sort of way, but he's still lovable.
But he is charming somehow, isn't he?
He is, but you know,
but he's charming.
Well, it's just we just love that pitch that he's given. He's just, you know, he's like quick. He's kind of, you mentioned the film noir movies. It felt kind of like, you know, those Clark Gable. You know, just that quick talk and stuff. You know, he talked about the waitress saying, "Oh, she's quick for a heavy one," and all that stuff. And he's just
on the way out of there, I thought he was going to goose her for a minute.
Well, he kept flipping that cane towards her. Yeah. He was just really fun in this
very
episode.
Very forward. Very forward.
Yeah. And, you know, it's surprising that they don't know. You know, I mean, they throw so many hints that he's a devil. I mean, the writing is kind of cute, too. I mean, there's a scene where the Pat Crowley says, "Speak of the devil." And, of course, Burgess Meredith comes in. And then there's a line where Burgess Meredith says something about, "Oh, did anyone ask if Paganini knew how to play the fiddle?" And, you know, if you know the legend about Paganini, he sold his soul so he could play the violin well. So all of these little obvious hints being thrown at the audience about who this character is kind of fun to see. But yeah, I actually enjoyed it. But mostly, you know, but the other part is right. There are lots of kind of like plot holes. I mean, the whole selling of the soul was really a hard, you know, thing for me to believe. I mean, the guy gave him $4,000, and boy, imagine how much inflation must be if it only costs like $4,000 to $5,000 to just run an entire newspaper. Wow, that's impressive. You know, he's just carrying around that cash in his pocket and stuff like that. And they're all accepting of it. So, you know, but admittedly, like the selling of his soul, I thought that was a bit of a stretch, and the ending was.
So, Lou, you saying that you felt being under distress as Winters was, that the contract wasn't binding?
You know what? No, I think it was binding. I mean, the devil just, you know, once you sign it, it's like, it's in ink, so I suppose that's what matters. But the idea is, you know, the only thing you can assume that Winters was so desperate to keep his newspaper going that he was willing to just overlook everything. He wasn't going to sell it to the rival paper, and if he had to sign this little paper as a kind of a lark to keep some sort of superstition going, you know, he did it. But still, it did seem a little, just too easy a way of setting that plot element into place.
Well, that's why in movies they have you sign in blood when you do
sometimes I wonder if they were going to say that, like if the printer's ink was actually blood, if that was the modification he made. But, you know, they never went into that into too much detail. But, you know, overall, I really enjoyed the episode. You know, but it did have its problems. Burgess Meredith is the one who really just sells the episode from beginning to end. He's just fun to watch. He did kind of remind me of the penguin in this episode. You know, for a bit, I thought he was going to do the rah, rah, but he didn't do it. And from what I just heard, I guess.
Yeah, I mentioned that in the written review, how he walked definitely reminded me of the penguin.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, it was a good episode. I would probably rate it like Lynn did, probably four out of four stars. I mean, there are plot elements that you have to overlook to kind of, like, accept the episode. But if you do, then it's fun. Burgess Meredith really delivers in this episode. And he is a great character actor. I mean, it's funny you mentioned character actors. I remember Paul Giamatti was once referred to as a character actor, and he said, I guess that just means I'm not good-looking.
Oh, he's terrific, though. God, Paul Giamatti is excellent. Oh, he's wonderful. Paul Giamatti's a fantastic actor.
Yeah, but I mean, he always
thought,
some people take
really
that term of character actor as an offense. It's kind of like what they're saying is that you don't have the looks to be a leading actor. So
it's funny, though, is that some character actors have made more money over their years in character acting than some of the lead actors have made. I mean, just if you look at some of their, you know, their catalog work.
Well, they definitely have much more memorable parts.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, some get stereotyped, that's true. But basically, I think some of the character actors are more memorable than the lead
guy. You're right. I was thinking of Burgess Meredith in Foul Play and how much he stood out in that role from the main characters, Chevy Chase and Goldie Hawn.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that whole, who was that, Ruth Gordon, right? He had a martial arts scene with, right?
Yeah.
Ruth Gordon always plays those weird roles anyway.
yeah. But no, that's what makes them fun to watch, admittedly. So, and that's what made this episode fun to watch, just watching Burgess Meredith just playing that role, smoking that cigar, and just seemingly having a fun time with it. So,
he's just charming and everything. He's just charming.
I'm trying to think if he ever was not charming. Was he charming in Rocky, in the Rocky series?
Don't fight him, Rocky. Not. He'll chew you up and spit you out.
Yeah, he was always. Yeah, you're a bum.
Yeah.
But then
what was that one line he used on Rocky when the girls came up to him? Women weak in knees. Women weak in knees.
Women weak in knees, Rocky.
I'm wondering if his voice was always that gravelly. I'm trying to remember. I wish I could remember some earlier Burgess Meredith, like, TV episodes or movies.
Well, one of the oldest movies that he was in was Of Mice and Men.
Oh, really? I never saw that.
No, yeah, that's one you'd want to see. It's an old movie. I think it's from, God, late 40s, early 50s. And he was a star. I guess he starred with another guy in that. But he was absolutely fabulous in that.
The movie Magic, too, where he plays Anthony Harkin's agent in that movie.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God, I forgot about that. Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely sensational.
Clash of the Titans, he was good in that one as well.
Yeah. Well, in Of Mice and Men, he was a young man, but he still looked old. He always looked like 20 years older than he really was. But he somehow pulled it off. He always pulled it off.
Oh, he always had his hair, right?
he did have his hair till the end.
I'm trying to remember. He actually did he ever win like any awards?
Did he win
an Academy Award for like his role in Rocky?
Supporting actress or something? Actress. What am I saying? Supporting actor. Yeah,
well,
actress.
Ron for Rocky for supporting.
Did he? Yeah, I'm trying to think. He should have. He definitely.
Won an Emmy Award for Outstanding Supporting Actor in a Comedy or Drama for the 1977 television film Taylor Gunner Joe.
Yeah. I just saw the Hitchcock movie and I was reminded how Hitchcock never won an award. I mean, he won like an AFI award late in his life, but like he never won an Oscar. And I'm wondering if, and there's a number of great actors and actresses.
I think he should have won supporting actor.
Huh?
And I think he should have won supporting actor for the Rocky movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
He's
one
of
the girls.
Yeah, he was fabulous in that. Well, what the hell was his first name? What was his name in the Rocky movies? Oh, my God, I can't believe I don't remember that. And I love those movies.
But he was Mickey. I think that was his
Mickey.
Name.
Mickey, yeah.
Mickey, yeah. Thank you.
I don't remember if he had a last name now.
Yeah.
He always called him Mick. Hey, Mick.
Yeah, Mick, thank you. Bear Fan Ron, yeah, thank you. Yeah, Mick. Yeah, he should have won for that. I mean, he was terrific. Especially remember the one where he was that he was in with Mr. That was the one where he died when he was in with Mr. T.
Yeah,
and after she knocked him out.
Had a heart attack and die, yeah.
Yeah,
he was nominated for Best Supporting Actor.
Okay, yeah, that I could see. I just wish he won. I mean, you know, it depends on the year, I suppose.
He should have won. I'll never forget that episode, that one scene where Mr. T knocks him down, and then he died in that episode. Oh, wow, that was heart-wrenching. I mean, I cried. I wanted to see that in the theater, and I was crying. Everybody, you hear everybody around going, sniffing, going, like, everybody's sniffing and crying. Oh my God.
I have to, and I hate to say it, you have to give credit to Sylvester Stallone in that scene. He actually sold it, the sadness.
Oh, yeah.
His body. Yeah, he did a really good job.
It was sad when he's laying on the table there and he asks him, did we win, Rock? Did we win? And then Rocky,
and he
lies.
Yeah.
Yeah,
he lies to him and says, yeah, that's good. Yeah. Oh, man.
Thank God he didn't ask Adrian. She's always like, you can't win, Rock.
Right. Adrian! Oh, God. All right, well, okay, so we have pretty much given this a very good rating all across the board, from 4s to 4.5s.
Felix in New Jersey gave it a 4 out of 5. So
Felix gave it a 4 out of 5. Bear fan, what are you giving this episode?
You gave it a 3.
Great, yeah. Okay, so we get a 3. And Bobby, you gave it a 4, right?
3, I think.
Bobby?
He's feeling generous.
3, not 4.
Oh, 3. Oh, okay, so 3. Yeah, he's being generous. 3 to 4.5. All right, so that's cool. All right, so.
Then, if I could bring it before we take off here, I wanted to mention, Dave can chime in with me on this as well, about Doctor Who and the missing episodes. I was listening to a podcast that work last night and called Radio Free Scaro, and they were going over some missing episodes that were found, and it's great because as some people don't know or might know, some of the episodes were erased during the 60s to save costs.
Many of them.
Yeah, especially the first and second actors who played the Doctor, William Hartnell, but really Patrick Troughton got it real bad. A lot of his stories were erased, unfortunately. But we had news that there was a fine, and of all places, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't a substation in Nigeria, Dave, that
they
found?
That's right. Yep.
Yep. And actually, it's great because on DVD, we just had Ice Warriors come out. And these two stories found are the next stories after the Ice Warriors. It was in Series 5. And it's called The World and the Web of Fear. And I believe the Web of Fear is important not just for the Yetis, but wasn't that the first unit or the introduction of unit during that time,
well,
Dave?
It was the first time we see the Brigadier, although he was only a colonel at the time. It was right. Colonel Lethbridge Stewart, not Brigadier Colonel Lethbridge Stewart. But
right.
He's in it. And there's still one episode of that missing. But it is good. They actually found 11 episodes, 2 of which they already had a copy of. So it made 9 new things. It's the largest single haul in one find. We found 2 recently, for Galaxy 4, and another one was found recently, and we were over the moon.
The Underwater Menace. Yeah.
Yeah. But this to get now. However, the news that was floating around, there are other TV shows that may well have been found as well. But some of us were hoping even more than this would have been found. But if they are going to find them, at least they were, as you said, Patrick Troughton ones. That was the ones that got most devastated. And I think Deborah Watling, who plays one of the companions, it's only about the second story of hers to survive.
Well, can I ask a question? Why were these episodes erased? Why were they? Is it because of the time period?
Well, two things. Because first of all, they never thought they were ephemeral things. They never thought that they would be watched so many years ahead.
They didn't think the way we did about reruns and syndication.
Yeah, and also, of course,
so it was a time period.
Yeah. Well, what was happened is as well that. The main copies were what's called telecine, or what do they call it? Basically, an actual the production monitor that they were, they used three cameras to make the, to film the episodes, and they were done almost like a play, a bit like armchair theatre in a way. And then the master, whichever camera was, you know, the camera that was live, as it were, that went to a main monitor, and basically they put a 16 millimeter camera in front of that and filmed that. But the actual studio tapes were so expensive. I mean, the tape recorder was the size of the president's desk. You know, you're talking about a massive, great big thing with reel to reels on it, with two inch wide tapes on. Now, it might sound ridiculous because we're going to say something like each tape cost £100. We think, well, that's not enough. But they were making the episode for about £600.
Jeez. Wow.
They were very fortunate in the United States that we didn't have that serious amount of wiping going on here than they had over in Britain
during that time. Well, I think that's because of, in America you had so much syndicated channels. They were already the second. There was already a market for the things to be recorded, and they filtered down to smaller and smaller stations. In the case of the Doctor Who, what happened is that the other thing is as well that we lost also a lot of colour in the later ones. We haven't lost the story
with John Pertwee,
but we lost the colour version, and all that remained was the actual tape, the black and white 16mm version, because that was the one that was sent abroad. And it was on, it was like on what they call the Pony Express idea, that you know, the tapes would go to one country and then 3 months later they go to another country. So places like New Zealand were seeing the episodes 2 years after they were first shown in the UK.
Wow.
But a lot of times the directive was there that once they were shown, they were supposed to be either sent back to the BBC or destroyed. Some stations didn't do that. And fortunately for us, they kept them, and now we're finding them years later. There's still 100 episodes missing.
I don't think also they had this idea of the actors' residuals all worked out at that time either. You know, I mean, I don't know what they get, but let's say they get 10% of what they originally got if it's shown in another country, or this, that, and the other.
Well, most of the syndication shown today, they get nothing unless you are an actual creator or writer of the series. As time goes on, the residuals get less and less and less, till finally it gets to a point where you get no residuals at all for the actor. Yeah.
Well, of course, the other thing is of sheer depreciation. I mean, the fact that, you know, if they were paid £100 for their $100 for acting 2 days on an episode, then which was probably a week's wages for them, and then the residuals went down to £10. Even though £10 was worth having in your pocket then, it's not worth having in your pocket 50 years on, you know what I mean? By the time your agent's taking $4
out of it. Yeah, I know what you mean. That makes sense, doesn't it? Wow.
And with the 50th anniversary coming up next month for Doctor Who, it's great, and it's been, you know, Twitter, and you can get it on iTunes now, these two stories I mentioned.
Everything goes to iTunes.
One of the amazing things is that when these DVDs come out, and you know, the extras on DVDs, they'll do things like commentaries, you know, where the actual two or three of the actual people that were involved in it will do a live commentary as an alternate audio track. I think with the Doctor Who actors like Colin Baker and so on, he probably gets paid more now to talk over the episode than he got paid to do the episode
when
he did
doing
it.
Yeah. Oh, God. That's amazing.
And I mean, you know, it's like other TV series like House, for example. I just rebought season one of House to do a comparison because I just got done rewatching season eight. And they come with commentaries, and it's great to listen to them because you have the director, producer, sometimes the actors and actresses, and they talk about that episode.
Season 8 is the last season. Oh.
It's sad, I know.
Are you a big House fan?
Oh, you don't want to ask that.
Oh, okay, I guess so.
Oh, my God.
I actually enjoy
House.
He's
a big House fan.
It's just the show started getting a little...
Oh, yeah,
he really is great.
Oh, my God.
And it's great how he could switch. He's a British actor, but can switch to the American accent, and you can't even tell.
So many British actors in American television and movies now—it's ridiculous, and they're playing American. It's like I just started watching the.
Lou, he was flawless.
No, I love Hugh Laurie. He's a talented man. He's great. But I thought by season 8, I mean, you know, the thing is, House does have a formula. I mean, it's never the first disease that they think it is, and you know, it's
great to watch the pilot and just see from that perspective with them starting out how it ends up. Yeah, with season 8.
Yeah,
so I'm on like episode 4 of season 1 now. So,
are you guys upset that Cuddy left?
She kind of had to. There were problems with the producers and her, and she wanted
I think
more money.
She was invited to come back to the final episode, but she turned it down. So,
she turned it down because they wouldn't pay her enough. Yeah, there were, and plus, what's his name? The guy who played Wilson, his best friend.
Yeah.
He was not going to come back, and then he did, because I think they made a deal with him.
Wow, that would have been terrible if Cuddy and...
Oh, my God, because then I was wondering how the hell would it have ended, you know?
Yeah.
Well, the whole season 8 is kind of a focal point on Wilson, so it's a good thing he did come back.
Exactly.
Yeah, great.
But it's kind of a buddy thing. The whole series is.
TV guy called it up. What was it? The bromance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right, guys. Well, let's just see. Our next show is on Saturday, October 26th, and that is No Time Like the Past, with starring Dana Andrews.
Which I like. He's a great actor. I remember him a lot in sci-fi.
Very good actor.
Horror
movies.
Very
good actor.
Yeah.
That episode, it's okay. It's okay. I didn't hate it. I didn't love it, but, you know.
Yeah, same here.
I might not make that one. I think I've got a family gathering that day, but I hope it's a good episode.
You're putting family before us? What in... God's name is wrong with you. Anyway.
Oh, I've signed this piece of paper now. I've got to go.
Oh, all right. Okay. All right, we'll let you slide on that one. Okay, guys. Well, the 26th, whoever can be here, would love for you to be here. Bear fan Ron, I hope you will be here on the 26th for No Time Like the Past. Felix left already, but he'll be here, I'm sure. And I hope Rick will be here again. And Lou, you'll be here. I know you'll be here. I just know you will. And of course, Dave just said he will. But everybody else will be here, so see you on the 26th for No Time Like the Past. Have a great rest of the weekend, everybody.
Bye.
Say
you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Say goodbye, Gracie.
Goodbye. Goodbye, Rocky. Have a wonderful night.
Goodbye, George.
Exit the infernal machine, and with it his satanic majesty, Lucifer, Prince of Darkness, otherwise known as Mr. Smith. He's gone, but not for good. That wouldn't be like him. He's gone for bad. And he might be back with another ticket to the Twilight Zone. For our next show, Mr. Dana Andrews makes his first visit to the Twilight Zone in a show called No Time Like the Past. You'll see him as a discontented inhabitant of the 20th century who goes back in time, back to what we assume to be the inviolate past, and violates it. A walloping performance, a strange and oddball theme, and an ending most unexpected in the tradition of The Twilight Zone.
You and I both share this dubious distinction with several million of our peers who inhabit the 20th century.
And you don't care for the 20th century.
I do not.
How did you know? You did, didn't you?
Yes, I knew. I knew there'd be a fire. But what I didn't know that I would cause it.